this meeting of the Climate and Energy Committee to order. Not a forum yet. We'll get one soon. It's going to be a great meeting, so people are going to be coming from everywhere. So, Representative Kraft, have you had a moment to look at the... Oh, never mind. Good idea. Oh, thank you.
So now I'm having an extra moment.
You have an extra moment. I like to do things by the rules. Okay, so we're going to hold off on approving the meeting minutes, but we're going to move on to our first bill, House File 2627. Representative Carroll. Oh, and we have a quorum, so maybe we will go ahead and quick do our minutes. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to take a look at the minutes of March 14th?
Madam Chair, I have, and I would move their approval.
Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Okay, now we're moving on to our first bill, House File 2627. Representative Carroll, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. I'm going to move that this bill be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment.
Great. And would you like to take a minute and tell us about your bill?
Sure. So this is about solar enclosed landfills. And as my mother-in-law would say, it's a might as well. So if you're doing something and another opportunity presents itself, you might as well do that. So I look at that as my mother-in-law's might as well bill. And I'll turn it over to my testifier to explain it.
Welcome, Mr. Logan O'Grady. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. By now, I think you're all familiar with me and Mencia, but just as a reminder, we are a 501c6 trade organization made up of over 140 member companies, all working within and throughout the solar and energy storage industries in Minnesota. Our member companies altogether employ over 5,000 Minnesotans throughout the state. I want to thank Representative Carroll for authoring this bill. I think it's a great way to implement solar on otherwise unusable land. Really, it's an opportunity for us to transform over 4,500 acres of otherwise unusable land into 950 megawatts of solar, enough to power 100,000 Minnesota homes. The grant breaks down barriers, retiring outstanding GO bonds that limit the use of solar on closed landfills, and provide upfront capital assistance in the development of closed landfills, as the complexity and unique features of siting solar on landfills can add up in costs. Again, our role as an industry organization is to provide an industry perspective. We compete in a 50-state market, and tools like this are tools in our toolbox to deploy more solar and more clean energy. So the really business signals that Minnesota is a great place to do business. Other than that, I would say that DG solar like this also strengthens our grid, makes it more efficient, lowering distribution needs and reducing transmission loss, more resilient to extreme weather events, and more secure, reducing reliance on singular localized power plants, and it will help meet our clean energy needs. So I can stick around. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. O'Grady. Would anyone else like to testify to this bill that's here today? Seeing none, and we'll turn to members' questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. So this is 2627, Madam Chair. That's the correct bill?
Yes.
Okay. Just a general question. In the testifier noticed that there was going to be 4,500 acres of land that would be potentially opened up to this. If this were to pass, would this money obligate all those grounds to open up all 4,500 acres?
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, no, this is just a start. The Environmental Quality Board conducted a study that was released in 2020 that looked at 110 potential sites. Of those, there are kind of a top five, and they looked at a number of different factors, including where are they in terms of interconnection to the utility, what makes the most sense. And so this bill is targeted at putting solar on those first five that are really great opportunities for solar.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of those five, where are those five?
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, they're a mix. I can get you the list, but they're a mix of in and out of XL territory, about half and half.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it are we talking industrial solar installations? Are we talking solar garden installations? What are we talking about?
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, it kind of depends on the site and what they could fit. Most sites can accommodate up to 1 megawatt, which could be either just a behind-the-meter, depending on the use of the energy at the site, depending on the ownership as well. It could be a public ownership, so it could be distributed to public buildings, for example, or it could accommodate a solar garden if that was enough.
Madam Chair. Yes. Will there any be recoup? Because the state taxpayers and ratepayers are actually the ones funding to allow this development, will there be any recuperation of the funds of essentially the profits that are gathered by developing this over the top of that to repay the state, the ratepayers and the taxpayers of Minnesota?
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, as we know, a great portion of the community solar garden program is that is credited to the people that sign up for the solar garden in that specific area. So those people will be receiving a bill credit for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So approximately, this is going to cost taxpayers and ratepayers $10 million just to not develop the land, but just allow it to be developed. Am I correct? Then how much per acre of development is that cost of these five locations that are in and out of XL Energy territory?
Mr. O'Grady.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, as I said, pretty much every single site within the EQB study can accommodate up to 1 megawatt of solar. You know, a 1 megawatt solar array could be anywhere from $800 to $1 million. So, and those take up 8 to 10 acres of land, roughly.
Madam Chair, I misspoke. I apologize. I said it was $10 million. It's actually 20. So it's $20 million. So this will allow for the $20 million will allow for the development of five locations. That's what we're saying. So five landfills, that's what we're talking about.
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, there's two purposes to this bill. The first is to pay off outstanding general obligation bonds. That's precluding development like this on this land because you cannot put revenue-generating systems on public land encumbered by GO bonds. And we are still working with MMB and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on that issue to figure out exactly how to do that. So there's bonds in there that are, there's money in there appropriated to pay off those bonds. So that would be one purpose of the bill. The other purpose of the bill would be to provide upfront grant money for solar installations. As we know, the price of solar has dropped over the last decade, but it still is the initial capital costs often is a challenge, especially to local units of government who oftentimes own these sites. So providing upfront grant money can help mitigate those barriers to developing solar on these sites.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. So you're going to use, my guess is that you'd use a community solar program on top of this. Then on top of that, you want a grant on top of that to develop these?
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, they may or may not put a solar garden on there. They might choose to, the owners of the land. That would be up to them.
Madam Chair, would the author of the bill or would the testifier of the bill would at least allow the disallowance of multiple, you know, layering these different programs? We already have a program that overpays for solar by 4 or 5 times of market rate with the community solar program, which another bill looks to expand that tremendously. And then we're going to allow folks to layer that with a grant. Would you at least allow that you can use one or the other? Like you can't use solar, but you can't have a grant, or you could have a grant, but not use solar gardens? Would you be open to that as far as so that we at least have a little bit of, you know, responsibility to ratepayers and taxpayers and the development of this these programs?
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, as a trade organization, our goal is to advance a competitive marketplace. So I think that would be an interruption into a competitive market, and it would interrupt Minnesota's choice of what they want to do with that property.
Madam Chair, and then, I don't think there's anything about competitive when we're dealing with, you know, ratepayers and taxpayers forking the bill to subsidize this program. And then on top of it, you get to also charge 4 times the rate by choosing which program you're going to submit the energy you produce into the system. I'm just asking, can we have a little bit of respect for taxpayers and ratepayers when it comes to that you're not doubling up on, you know, the multiplicity of these programs, and it doesn't sound like that's even an option.
Representative Carroll.
Madam Chair, Representative Sawinski, you raise a point, and I'd be happy to have continued discussions with you. Thank you.
That's all I wanted. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Carroll. If you could just explain to me, just really basic level, as we are, you know, again, it was a little bit following his questions, but with the $20 million investment from the taxpayers and then the RDA, what is the benefit? I would like to know, like, a cost analysis, you know, because usually if you invest in something, what do you get back? So just really, really basic, what is the payback on this project?
Thank you for that question. I'll let Mr. O'Grady answer that.
Go ahead, Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative Altendorf, I think it's a broad question, but if you look at solar broadly and specifically in this opportunity here, is you're not doing anything economically with this land as it already exists, right? You can't do anything else with it, really. So the opportunity here is to raise the economic use of otherwise unusable land. A lot of that land is owned by public entities, and so if you're building solar on it, that public entity then can lower their utility bills, not only at that site, but potentially at other public sites. So you'd have a monthly savings in your energy costs because you'd be producing it and using it yourself.
And then Representative Altendorf, I also was just brought to my attention. I wasn't necessarily thinking about it, but the bonds are going to be paid off by the state anyway. It's just being paid off at a different rate. So just keeping that in mind.
Okay. And of Altendorf. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that answers my question.
Any other questions? Not seeing any. Representative Carroll, would you like to make any closing comments?
I just appreciate your support, and we'll refer it on to Commerce.
And with that, Representative Carroll renews his motion that House File 2627 be re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor?
You're right. Sorry. I misspoke. Capital Investment.
You're all good. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails, and your bill is on its way to Capital Investment. Next up, thank you for being here. So next up we have House File 2524 with Representative Kraft. And while he's making his way, I can move House File 2524 be laid over for possible inclusion. And it looks like there's an A1 amendment, Representative Kraft.
Yes, there is, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A1.
Any discussion of the A1 amendments? None. All those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So let's see. Representative Kraft, would you like to tell us about the House File 2524 as amended?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm excited to bring to us a terrific opportunity in the form of House File 2524. The clean energy transition is happening, and Minnesota is a leader in this transition. Even more so with the 100% clean energy legislation just signed into law a few weeks ago. This bill is about helping Minnesota entrepreneurs tap into the huge business opportunity that comes along with this transition. It's about helping to create groundbreaking new solutions and products, as well as Minnesota jobs. Today, an unmet need exists to equip and support entrepreneurs and emerging businesses in their efforts to commercialize innovative energy technologies. This bill fills that gap by providing direct business support for energy entrepreneurs and startup businesses through the Minnesota Energy Alley Initiative. Minnesota Energy Alley will provide connections, networks of support, training, best practice sharing, and seed funding to accelerate the development and commercialization of promising clean energy technologies. While there are other state-funded programs that assist entrepreneurs and business owners, as you'll hear from our testifiers, the energy sector has unique needs. There's no one doing what the Energy and Alley Initiative can do. This is also about making Minnesota competitive across the Midwest and the country in attracting the entrepreneurial businesses of tomorrow. There are over 20 states who have similar programs to support energy entrepreneurs and startups. This bill is about strengthening our state's energy and economic development future. So we're asking for an appropriation of $5 million. Before I turn it over to my testifiers to talk about what this buys us, I do want to acknowledge that there are a couple areas in the bill that are still being worked. It's my plan to add a 10% cap on administrative expenses, as well as having a bit more detail on what will be included in the required reporting. Given that this bill is being laid over, we'll be working those issues before it is finalized, and if members have comments on those, I would welcome them. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Mass. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Good afternoon, Chair Akam and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Mast, and I'm the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, or SEEM as we are known. We are an industry-led, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization representing the business voice for clean energy in the state. I'm thrilled to be here today to testify in support of House File 2524 as amended, which will support the formalization of Minnesota Energy Alley, a critical initiative to nurture and support our energy entrepreneurs and emerging businesses developing the next generation of energy solutions across our state. As an organization with a diversity of member businesses working throughout the energy technology spectrum, as exemplified in this logo cloud, we know that by harnessing the ingenuity and power of our private sector business community, we are able to deliver sustainable energy solutions that benefit our economy. However, as we also know, as our energy system continues to evolve, we must be keenly focused and intentional about developing the energy solutions needed that aren't in the market today to ensure that our state continues to prosper. Minnesota Energy Alley addresses this unmet need by equipping and supporting our energy entrepreneurs and our emerging businesses with direct business support, surrounded by industry expertise to help accelerate the commercialization and deployment of innovative energy technologies. We can't stand idly by simply hoping and wishing that entrepreneurs and companies are able to successfully create the next energy breakthrough alone in a vacuum. Together with the state, we must roll up our collective sleeves to provide them with specialized expertise, connections, and resources to help them bring their breakthrough ideas to market. Doing so will retain and grow our Minnesota energy startups, while also providing a beacon for attracting businesses and investment from outside of our state's borders, whether domestically or internationally. While we may be playing catch-up with the 20-plus other states who have already formalized similar initiatives to support emerging energy businesses in their states, I'm supremely confident that Minnesota Energy Alley will not only make us more competitive, but that it will make Minnesota the go-to place for developing energy-focused businesses and technologies. So, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'd now like to turn it over to Nina Axelson to briefly discuss Minnesota Energy Alley programming in more detail, but I'd also like to thank Representative Kraft for his chief authorship of this important and timely bill and would appreciate the committee's support.
Welcome to committee, Ms. Axelson. When you get settled, state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Akam, committee members, Representative Kraft. And thank you, Greg and SEEM, for your leadership in advancing the clean energy economy. For the record, my name is Nina Axelson. I'm the founder and president of Grid Catalyst. I also serve on the board of directors for SEEM. I offer my comments through the lens of 16 years working in the energy industry and 5 years working with energy startups directly. I appreciate the opportunity to share how Minnesota Energy Alley will support entrepreneurs and advance our regional economy by offering programming along a continuum. So as you can see from the graphic, we start at the widest reach. How do we get more students, young people, people early in their career, thinking about how to be in STEM-related opportunities that aren't just in the sciences, but also in entrepreneurship and business? Expanding and mobilizing an innovation network is that next stage. We are familiar with a lot of Minnesota clean tech and energy leaders, energy companies, higher education, our utilities. We have this clean tech resource here of expertise. We have to mobilize them to be collaborators, investors, and early adopters of tech. They're a critical aspect of making this program successful. then we have training programs that can move those startups into the market faster, with their tech and business model getting refined alongside experts and road tested in real world applications. And that's the big differentiator here that we point out in these last two stages. Proof of concept step is critical. Energy startups fail when they can't secure a pilot that's needed to get their first customer. Funding demonstration projects can bring tech to market years earlier, and providing this advantage can make Minnesota a go-to region for startups to thrive, deploy, manufacture, and hire. When we look at similar startup and innovation programming, we see significant results. Startup businesses generate 40% more revenue, and growth of employees is 36% higher. Another example is the Virtue Lab in Oregon, which was initiated with a $6 million investment from the state. After a decade of programming, they have created over 450 jobs and have secured $230 million in follow-on funding. I really want to impress this point. That means that $38 of private investment was generated for every dollar of initial state investment. That is great for our regional economy. Programs like Minnesota Energy Alley work. We have the other example here with Medical Alley that has helped Minnesota become a globally recognized med tech innovation hub, with partner companies raising $650 million since 2010. It's a very similar model. Minnesota has everything it takes to also lead in energy innovation. To gain a global edge and regional outcomes, we need Minnesota Energy Alley to move us forward. Thank you again to the committee, Chair, and Representative Kraft for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll turn to member questions. Representative Kuczynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question. You know, you talk about, you know, we want to focus this potential new program on, you know, new entrepreneurs, new ideas. What is the filter that you use so that this money just doesn't get passed to folks that are already operating in the state? You know, is this just going to help fund a sales team, or will you actually be developing new technology, patentable type devices? You know, what exactly, how will you use that as a filter?
Mr. Mack?
Madam Chair, Representative Sobczynski, thank you for the good question. The way that the program will be designed to work is it will be providing that direct business support to those entrepreneurs and early stage companies that are pre-seed, where they haven't raised money as of yet. It may be in an idea stage or almost ready for proof of concept. And so we will surround them with industry expertise and the almost accelerator-like business programming to help speed them to that first pilot or first demonstration. And that is the critical juncture in which many of our startups today working in the energy space are failing to reach that first big milestone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a follow-up to that. So, you know, obviously the state of Minnesota and potential business here is going to, you know, Minnesota lately has shown its ability to scare businesses away when it comes to new manufacture. You know, what guarantees will the taxpayers of Minnesota have that, you know, we'll help develop a patentable device or whatnot, and then the manufacturer and construction will just go to China? What safeguards do we have for Minnesota taxpayers that won't happen through this bill?
Mr. Mass. Or Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Sobczynski, I think the big focus area for the work that our organization does, providing and working directly with industry, is ensuring that we're retaining Minnesota jobs working in this industry, that we're also expanding Minnesota-based jobs, and it's across the economic sector. So whether that is manufacturing, whether it's power generation, transportation, those are the areas in which we are looking to provide that direct support so that companies are continuing to grow. And at the same time, we also know that there are companies looking to Minnesota as a place to do business, and they're looking for direct partners. And so it will be across the entire supply chain, but manufacturing, as well as ensuring that these types of products and services that will be developed are going to have that local economic impact in the state.
Representative Susan.
Thank you. Are there guarantees written into the bill to guarantee that happens?
Mr. Mass, or Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Sobczynski. There's not specific guarantees written into the bill.
Representative.
Madam Chair, because we're spending, you know, $5 million of taxpayers' money, and then potentially even, you know, to garner outside investment, whether it be from outside the state or inside the state, to develop these ideas, essentially generate these patentable products. Do you feel that that might be a good option to say, you know what, hey, we want you to develop these things, but with that seed money, we're going to help develop you also have to make a commitment to the taxpayers of Minnesota that you're going to create the jobs here and not just take it to some other part of the country or world to make your products. Would you be open to that?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, I'm open to that discussion, the intricacies of that kind of a thing. I'd want to talk to partners on, but this is intended to be something to expand the entrepreneurial and business and jobs in Minnesota. So, you know, I think the devil's in the detail and something like that.
Thank you.
Mr. Mass.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm Representative Swedzinski. Part of the intention with the Minnesota Energy Alley Initiative is working in this industry for nearly two decades. We have seen actually more companies leaving the state of Minnesota with many of these high potential ideas and growing their businesses elsewhere. And that's also the gap that we are looking to fill with this particular initiative. How do we ensure that they have the expertise and that direct business support in order for them to not only stay in Minnesota, but grow in Minnesota? So I really appreciate your question.
Seeing none, any last comments, Representative Kraft?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So appreciate the questions and your support. Not only can this help Minnesota achieve our energy and emission reduction goals, but Minnesota Energy Alley is an investment in our state's future and a way to support early stage energy businesses and create a thriving entrepreneurial ecosystem around our clean energy leadership. So thank you.
And with that, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Mr. Mass. And next, Representative Kraft, you have another bill up, House File 2269.
I do. I would move that House File 2269 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Great. And I see that you have a DE. Would you like to tell us about your DE, or should we...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move my DE, the DE-1. There was a number of changes to the bill. It just made more sense to have a DE versus going through individual things, and it's the form in which I'd like the bill considered.
Great. Any questions? All those in favor of the DE, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Kraft, would you like to tell us about the bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would. Madam Chair, members of the committee, a few weeks ago, I brought a bill before you, House File 772, on commercial building energy codes. At that time, I discussed that 40% of Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions come from buildings and about half of that from commercial buildings. While HF 772 was about making our new buildings super energy efficient, this really important bill, 2269, deals with the other side of the coin, or existing commercial buildings. HF 2269 is built on the concept that you can't reduce what you don't measure. It requires building owners of buildings greater than 50,000 square feet to measure their energy usage and share it publicly. It creates an Energy Star-like rating for buildings and then provides tools for building owners to market their ratings. Just having this benchmarking data on its own has been shown to reduce energy usage on average 1 to 3% per year. And as, if not more importantly, this provides a foundation for future programs to reduce energy usage. House File 2269 also builds on experience that several Minnesota cities have with benchmarking programs. We know how to do this. In the bill, we've included some money for three different areas, one for the Department of Commerce to create the program and set up a support structure for building owners, for utilities that may need to create or adjust some internal systems to provide this data, and also a grant to focus on the workforce side of this by creating more trained building engineers. As you can see from some of the letters that are in the material, we've had some good stakeholder engagement so far and will continue to work the bill. For example, one additional change that has been identified are some tweaks needed to build on the building exclusion language to make sure, for example, that buildings at mines are exempted. I'm open to further changes as this moves on to judiciary and then and then I imagined back to us for possible inclusion. There has been a, I'll note, there's been a fiscal note requested on the bill, though it is not yet available. It certainly would be before any inclusion in an omnibus.
And it looks like you have a few testifiers.
I do.
First, we have Russ Stark, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of St. Paul. Welcome to committee, Mr. Stark. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for having me. My name is Russ Stark. I'm the Chief Resilience Officer of the City of St. Paul, where I work on climate action and sustainability. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. The St. Paul has an ordinance very similar to this bill. Covers buildings 50,000 square feet and larger, and those buildings account for 45% of all building energy used in the city, and about 25% of the city's citywide greenhouse gas emissions. Having good information about building energy use is good for transparency in the real estate market and allows us to identify and assist low-performing buildings. The city began our benchmarking work as a voluntary program in 2018 and moved into an ordinance in 2020. With a good deal of effort, we were able to get about 19% of our largest buildings benchmarking through the voluntary program. Once we moved to the mandated program, we've gotten up to 90% compliance, and that covers about 675 buildings in St. Paul. We found that making the process easy for the building owners and operators is key. We've done this through a lot of training, webinars, and provided one-on-one assistance for those folks to participate. Each year, we take the time to recognize the good work of the owners and operators who have some of the highest performing buildings, which they much appreciate. And so we support this bill to make energy benchmarking a statewide requirement. And I stand ready for any questions the committee members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. Do you have a question from Representative Swazinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to appreciate your testimony, what kind of resources does the city put into tracking this information as you get it in from business owners?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, excuse me. To understand your question, when you ask what kind of resources, you mean sort of what kind of
staff, money,
sure.
Time, what would you estimate that the city spends calculating this for the city of St. Paul?
Mr. Stark.
Yes, thank you for the question. So, Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, we have about the equivalent of a half of an FTE that implements this program.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. So about a half. Did the city receive any grants or anything to help support them in this endeavor, like from the state or federal government?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, we did receive some philanthropic support to get started. But at this point, the city is financing our work on the ordinance.
Thank you. Just on average, so you have roughly 600 buildings that have the potential to comply. Sounds like 90% of them do comply. Kind of what on average would you say, you know, you said the simplicity of the paperwork is key. What do you estimate the average for the average owner? What do they spend, half an hour on filling something like that out, or?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, it's there's a little bit of startup time to sort of get your building set up in Portfolio Manager, which is the system that it's used for tracking. So that first year is a bit more time. It might take a couple of hours, a little bit of back and forth. And then ongoing, it's really easy to just update the data that you're receiving from your utilities. It's probably on the order of an hour of annual work.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So there's a computer program. Did the city provide that program, or was the businesses have to purchase that?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, the system that we use is actually an Environmental Protection Agency program called Energy Star Portfolio Manager. I believe that's the same that's intended through the bill. So it's available to anyone actually to use today. Building owners could do that on their own today. Many of them actually do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just kind of going back, you said you have 90% compliance. How does the city handle the 10% that are non-compliant? Kind of what resources do you use? Kind of what have you used? You know, what's been working to get those 10% into compliance?
Mr. Stark.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, so far we are just using all carrots. We aren't using any enforcement tools at our disposal, even though it is a city ordinance. And we've gotten to that 90% mark through those methods. In some cases, because the information that we have about building owners may just be a mailing address, we're just not certain that we're reaching the right party for some of those 10%. And so we're taking some time to try and figure out, make sure our contact information is up to date, and just continuing to try to reach out to them.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just to wrap up, so what has the City Council spoken on, kind of what are they getting upset by that 10% that's potentially not, or kind of what's the timeline that they want them in compliance?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, because it's a relatively new program still, I think expectations were met with the 90% goal. Of course, we're going to try to get that all the way up to 100. I think there's some patience in that process right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just from a data standpoint, do you protect that data? Is it open source? To, you know, how is that data kept within the city?
Mr. Stark.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, so through our program, building owners essentially give us their data, or give us access to their data. It becomes public once they've given us access to their energy data.
Representative Susan.
Thank you.
Are you good for now?
Sure.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And this is kind of the converse of Representative Swazinski's question. With 90% compliance, at least 90% compliance, is it fair to say it's been well received by the property owners?
Mr. Stark.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it has. We spent a lot of time talking to our building owners and business owners leading up to the implementation of this ordinance, answering questions. We actually got a round of applause at our Business Review Council for this ordinance because we took some of their advice about how to shape it. It's been very well received.
Thank you.
Any follow-up? All right, we'll go on to our next testifier, Max Curie, President and Chief Engineer at Suntide Commercial Realty. Welcome to committee, Mr. Curie. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Max Curie. I work at Suntide Commercial Realty. We are a property management company in Minnesota, and so we own and manage commercial properties. We have dealt with particularly the program portfolio manager for Energy Star for probably 15 years, long before benchmarking existed. It is the entity that allows you to create an Energy Star score for your building. And so several of our buildings we've won awards for in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and one in Roseville. And some of those were pre-benchmarking ordinance. And it was a tool we were familiar with. I would say half of the property management companies or building owners in the state of Minnesota would probably be at least somewhat familiar with Portfolio Manager. And it's been a great tool for us to rank our buildings against other buildings and sort of promote that as, you know, attracting new tenants and sort of how that goes. Nobody wants to have the last building on the list. And so I think it is somewhat of a driver for building operators and owners to focus on energy efficiency and improve that. You know, in Minnesota, but in the United States in general, generally the tenants pay utilities and the owners own the building. And so there's not a whole lot of incentive generally for buildings that are leased out to other people to do energy improvements. And this is one way, at least from a, you know, attracting new tenants point of view, to make that happen.
And great, thank you so much for your testimony. Did you have a question,
Representative? Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just roughly how many square feet do you manage?
We manage about 3 or 3.5 million square feet in Minnesota. The majority of that is in the Twin Cities. We did have three, we managed three large buildings in the city of Minneapolis that were within the benchmarking ordinance size for Minneapolis. We currently manage three buildings within that size in St. Paul. Okay. And I don't think that there are any other cities yet in Minnesota that have an ordinance that we are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of what's your portfolio when it comes to manufacturing spaces versus office spaces? What does that look like?
We're primarily office and light industrial. And so we don't have any large manufacturing facilities. I don't think that from a tenant attraction point of view, it's obviously a different thing in manufacturing. I think it would be almost less onerous in manufacturing from the point of view of entering the data is easy and you don't have a lot of tenants or a lot of meters in those, generally in those buildings. I have limited experience.
Representative. Thank you. And just finally, don't get me too picky, but just kind of in general, we hear a lot of what's going on in the economy. You know, what's your vacancy rate, you know, or under use rate? So if you're, even if you're renting a, let's say a thousand square feet, obviously larger than that, but what percentage of those feet are actually being utilized by the companies under current lease?
Mr. Curry.
Understood. So your question is not only what is leased, but what is utilized? Okay. I would say that in the last 6 to 9 months, the vast majority of our leased space is substantially occupied on a daily basis. We can tell that mostly from parking counts and card swipes at buildings. And it is definitely coming back relatively strongly. It seems to be, you know, a lot of flex hours, and people seem to be taking a lot of Mondays and Fridays off as a work-from-home kind of a thing. But essentially, you know, our buildings would be, on average, more than 80% occupied in the Twin Cities for office. And those spaces would be in use 5 days a week, substantially.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Curry. Next on our testifier list is Marcy Conrad. Marcy Conrad Nutt with AIA Minnesota. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Ackam and members of the committee. My name is Marcy Conrad Nutt. I am here with the American Institute of Architects. I am personally a licensed architect with over 20 years of experience, a LEED accredited professional, certified passive house designer, and I head sustainability initiatives at Alchemy Architects in St. Paul. And I've worked on a variety of work, residential, institutional, and commercial in my career. As I said, I'm here today on behalf of the American Institute of Architects Minnesota, which represents more than 2,300 architecture and design professionals, to offer our support for House File 2269, which establishes energy benchmarking for Minnesota buildings. The climate impact of buildings is well known. As much as 40% of our carbon footprint comes from the construction and operation of buildings. Architects can help their clients make sustainable choices when they are constructing buildings, and that has a significant impact. But we must also understand more about our energy footprint in existing buildings if we are to identify ways to reduce the climate impact of the built environment on a meaningful scale. Energy benchmarking is not a new practice, as you've heard. Cities and states across the United States, including some Minnesota cities, have similar benchmarking programs in place. This common sense measure can help business owners identify ways to improve building performance, which could save them money in long-term operating costs, along with reducing the building's climate impact. The EPA's Energy Star Portfolio Manager, which is the tool recommended in the bill, is one commonly used in jurisdictions that benchmark. That means there is already considerable expertise available to architects and building owners as they implement benchmarking in Minnesota. And now we can examine Minnesota data alongside that of other jurisdictions to understand trends and opportunities. In addition, focusing this program on larger buildings while allowing for reasonable exemptions is a smart approach, We encourage you to consider funding incentives and supportive programming to help commercial building owners interpret their results and implement positive changes in their buildings. We believe that support is a critical piece of making this program a success. More and more, our clients want to see sustainable building practices, and their clients, including tenants, expect to live or work in energy-efficient and healthy buildings. Without taking the step of broadly implementing commercial building benchmarking, it can be a significant challenge to improve our existing buildings. We see this as an essential step to help reduce the carbon footprint of our built environment and move our state toward its net zero energy and carbon goals. So we urge you to pass House File 2269. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And last on the list, we have Mike Bull with Minnesota Power. Welcome to committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Bull. I'll try to be brief. A little bull goes a long way. We appreciate the opportunity to provide brief testimony about House File 2269. We and several others met with Representative Kraft yesterday to talk about this bill, and we certainly appreciate how generous he was with his time and attention. I was the policy director at the Center for Energy and Environment for nearly a decade, and I definitely understand the value of building benchmarking policies. It can be a very important tool. However, we do have several concerns with this bill as currently drafted, and I'll share a few of those with you. First, the bill seems to require the disclosure of the energy use of some of our largest customers. Representative Kraft has indicated that that's something he'd like to address. This is information that those customers vigorously protect, as its disclosure can result in a competitive disadvantage in an intensely competitive global market. So we appreciate the attention there. Second, the bill would require us to invest in expensive information technology as well as to dedicate significant utility resources towards working with a large number of building owners spread out across northern Minnesota to ensure that those building owners understand and can comply with their obligations under the bill. If they don't comply, there are penalties built in. So their understanding is really important, and a lot of hand-holding, I think, will be important. And doing that in the compressed time frame under the bill would divert scarce Minnesota Power resources away from implementation of the energy conservation and optimization legislation that was passed in the previous legislature. The bill as proposed will make it much more difficult for us to do the high-quality work under ECO that our customers deserve and that we expect from ourselves. And finally, the bill raises data privacy and legal concerns that are very important to understand and get right before the bill goes into effect. The Minnesota PUC has been grappling with these issues for many years. An indication of the complexity associated with these issues and the importance of measuring twice before cutting once. Again, we appreciate Representative Kraft's time and attention yesterday, but we're not able to support the bill in its current form. Our preference would be that we lay it over for interim work so that we can make sure we get the biggest bang for the ratepayer funds we will need to invest on its implementation and to avoid unintended consequences. However, we will work with Representative Kraft, Senator Mitchell, and the advocates to improve the bill if the preference is to move it forward yet this session. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I'm happy to stand for any questions. I'm also happy to not.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm not seeing any. Oh, I am seeing a question. Representative Kuczynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just did we receive, was there a fiscal note with this bill at all?
I believe Representative Kraft said it's been requested, but it has not been completed yet. It's okay. In the works.
Thank you. And then what was the estimate? You know, we heard from the city of St. Paul themselves that they have a half a FTE just for this one city. I'm guessing the state of Minnesota would be multiple times that as far as staff, as far as the, how many FTEs are they estimating would be at the state level?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Kuczynski. So the fiscal note hasn't come back, so we don't have the FTE thing, but we've anticipated the need for that and put in $1 million over the next 2 years. What you find with these benchmarking programs is there's, as was mentioned by Mr. Stark, was that there's a bigger investment up front, and then once you get folks together, then that drops away. So we've tried to estimate that, but we'll wait to see from the fiscal note the exact numbers.
Representative Susan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just, you know, roughly, you know, it sounded like it could be 20 hours or 30 hours potentially to get set up by the time you go to the trainings and whatnot. You know, I noticed in your DE that you have a penalty of $1,000 to the city of St. Paul doesn't even have that. You know, why would you penalize a company for doing something that they're not being reimbursed for at all to comply with?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, so I'll point out that the language there was May, and it's something that we're willing to look at. All right, and I think there should be some maybe phased in over time or something that says, you know, this is a requirement. But I agree with the approach that that once folks start doing this, it's easy and there's a lot of benefit to it. And so we need to get them over that hurdle.
Representative Susan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, I would just recommend, you know, Ms. Representative Kraft, that, you know, we've got, you know, we just talked about in the last committee. So last hearing that you literally just had before this, you know, one of the biggest issues we have with manufacturing is that they'll develop a product here in Minnesota and then they leave. And this is one of the things of why those businesses leave and why they maybe need some extra help to get them to stay here is because you have bills that the state requires that there's no reimbursement for, and then if you don't, you're going to get a $1,000 fine. It's difficult enough to get the permits to build a manufacturing plant. It's difficult enough to get the permits to actually build a place in the state of Minnesota. We're not making it easier by any of the bills we're hearing. Now we're going to fine them, too, if they don't send the information to the state of Minnesota that we're demanding of them. That's why we have to have bills, your previous bill, to try to get sweeten the pot a little bit enough so that they're willing to look over all this other stuff and these extra things that they're going to have to send into the state. And, you know, when is enough enough? We already passed the carbon free. That's going to solve all the problems across the state. And now on top of that, we're going to have extra demands, not only just extra bills because of the higher energy costs that families and businesses are going to have to pay because of that bill. Now we're going to have extra fines that we're going to have to worry about if we don't happen to have anyone that's on staff enough to fill out the paperwork. You know, I think, you know, two bills together just seem interesting. We've got to have help over here so these folks will develop jobs in Minnesota because of the regulatory environment, because they'll create an idea and then they leave with it because it's so difficult to do it. And then we've got ones like this that pretty much state why that's necessary. And, you know, I just hope that you said that's something you'd be willing to look into. I understand you want to ask for this information, but at least get rid of the fines, or at least on top of getting rid of the fines, actually reimburse those businesses for giving the information. If it's so valuable, pay them for it.
Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, thank you for the question and thoughts. As I mentioned, you know, I'm open to looking at the penalty side of this, and that's not the spirit of this. I would point out that, and you heard from one of the testifiers here, that once they do this, it's actually a competitive advantage for the building owners, that they save money. So I don't know about, you know, giving them money for the data, unless we were to talk about them giving money back for the energy that they save. So I don't agree with that approach, but I think it's this kind of thing, right, that is not hard to do, that provides a foundation for buildings to differentiate themselves and for people to want to live in them or have their businesses reside in them.
Any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, Representative Kraft, would you like to any closing statements and renew your motion?
I would. I would say this is a really important bill for dealing with existing commercial buildings. As I said, you can't reduce what you can't measure. I really do appreciate the thoughtful comments and input, and I will take that seriously to heart as we move this forward, but this is an important bill. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2269 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to judiciary. And we're going to now pass the gavel.
Yep.
And
while Chair Akam is getting over there, I will move that House File 2432 be laid over for possible inclusion. And when you're ready, Madam Chair, please tell us about your bill.
All right, sorry. Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting House File 2432, to expand our existing community solar program. Solar energy comes in many forms, ranging in size from rooftop to the current 1 megawatt community solar program to utility scale solar. Each of these options has pros and cons on issues of cost, flexibility of siting, and interconnection to the grid. But all of them are a needed solution to our climate crisis. In Minnesota, we were pioneers of the community solar industry that started over 10 years ago. We currently have a successful subscriber-based community solar program where residential, commercial, and public entities can purchase subscriptions to offset their energy use. The bill today is proposing to expand on this existing program by including all public utilities, removing the current contiguous counties requirement, allowing for up to 5 megawatt projects, and including the community access program, which, as you will hear from testifiers today, is designed to include higher percentage of residential subscribers with a focus on attracting low-income and moderate-income Minnesotans who are often left out of this conversation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have a list of speakers or testifiers that will be presenting on the bill.
I understand our first testifier will be Whitney Terrell. Whitney, come down. And what we'll do is we have a number of testifiers, so if it's all right, we'll hold questions to the end. But welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and receive your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me and excited to offer my testimony. My name is Whitney Terrell, and I'm a resident of Hopkins, Minnesota. I'm here to share with you my personal testimony about the importance of having the option to subscribe to community solar. My family and I moved to Hopkins about 7 years ago, and we live in a condo that we purchased for our first home. It was such a great option for us several years, more than a year ago, to have purchased a subscription to community solar, which hopefully will be online soon. It's an array that's located in North Minneapolis and Hennepin County. But one of the challenges that having a subscription solved for us is that we didn't have to put the array on our building. We had the opportunity to put the array in a location that's significant to us. I imagined when I purchased the subscription that I'd be able to tell my family members or other friends and families who know about North High that the array is in a place that they recognize, and hopefully they would feel confident to subscribe themselves. But one of the things I'm most excited about for community solar is that it will hopefully save my family a lot of money in terms of our energy. It empowers us to not have to convince our the hundreds of units that are part of our homeowners association to adopt solar. It allows us to make that choice for our family. And then further, I'm thinking about the 20,000 or so people who live in Hopkins. Especially in our city, it would make a big difference. 38% of the residents in Hopkins are people who are over 40, people who identify as people of color, and we have over 40 languages for people who are also of color. So, but the majority of those people, 95%, are renters. So having the option to have community solar access is an equity issue for Hopkins. I don't want to speak on behalf of the city, but just as someone who lives there, I can definitely see this helping a lot of people like myself who live in the community and who I think should have this option. So thank you. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Natividad Seafeld. And I'll read the next person. It will be Winton Boyd will be up next.
Hello,
So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Natividad Seafeld, and I am the president of Park Plaza Cooperative in Fridley, Minnesota. I'm also the resident who has lived there since 1998 and has seen a lot of change before we became a cooperative and after. We're currently at the home to 81 families, and about two dozen or so have now had the opportunity to spend the last couple of years or so enjoying solar. And the biggest thing for us was the fact that we had help from North Country Cooperative Foundation, as well as Cooperative Energy Futures, who is also a cooperative, who came to our community and helped us understand what solar was going to mean to us. We were able to become members with a $25 membership, which for us as low-income families, we were like ecstatic. How do you get solar for 25 bucks, right? So we all jumped on board and signed up as soon as we could and have saved some money quite a bit, some of us even more than normal. I haven't paid a XL Energy bill in 3 years. Sometimes I pay $25 just because I feel bad. So it's really fun. We have expanded our program, especially by adding the community. If we expand the program, especially by adding community access program, more of our neighbors, low-income residents, and renters in general would be able to join and get the same benefits just like we have in our community. We would like to see more low-income families, fixed-income families, single moms and single dads be able to utilize solar as much as we have. The community access program deserves a higher bill credit because of the added cost to developers in order to expand equity and access to populations that typically do not get to participate in such opportunities, such as low-income people and families. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Quinton Boyd, and Quinton will be followed by Larry Weiss. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, committee. My name is Winton Boyd. I'm a native and proud Minnesotan and a property owner in Hennepin County in Minneapolis, an ordained pastor and a grandfather of two young Minnesotans. My wife and I were delighted to discover the possibility of solar gardens when we returned to this state as property owners 4 years ago. We first had a condominium, and now we have a home, urban home in Minneapolis. In neither place was it actually possible to construct panels on site or on the dwelling. But as longtime advocates of alternative energy and encouraged by an employee of U.S. Solar who was a friend of our young son, we were delighted to sign up for the solar garden through U.S. Solar. We also proudly display a little sign on our yard to that effect, and we know from many positive conversations that sign generates, more and more people would like to take part in this kind of effort because of their desire to do something to help climate catastrophes. I'm here today to advocate for the passage of this bill so Minnesota remains a leader, as it was in 2013 when we passed legislation to authorize these gardens. As you have heard, the program has been a success, and continued growth means we need more landowners who love the consistent income of solar gardens. We need more acreage, which remains very pollinator-friendly, even with solar arrays, and we need fewer geographic restrictions. Just as other states have learned from us, we can now learn from them in reducing the need to live in the county one's garden is located. We all know that the increased use of and dependence on alternative energy, especially solar, requires forethought, intention, commitment, and courage against the many explicit and unconscious pressures that drive climate change. This is a proven route, these solar gardens, and this is a perfect time and a perfect session to keep the efforts moving forward. It's a win for consumers and a win for our natural resources. It is clean electricity and it promotes energy independence at local and regional levels. Finally, I look forward to explaining to my 4- and 2-year-old grandchildren, when they are able to understand, why we have bought into solar gardens, why it is an important choice, and how it is helping to preserve this great state for their future. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Larry Weiss, followed by Timothy Denherter-Thomas.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Larry Weiss, and I live in Minneapolis. And thank you for the opportunity to speak here, Madam Chair and Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. I'm here in support of House File 2432 to improve Minnesota's community solar program. My wife and I have been community solar subscribers, customers of U.S. Solar, for about 5 years. It was hassle-free, it cost us nothing to sign up, and it saved us about $100 a year in energy costs. But overwhelmingly, most important to us, it guaranteed that the total amount of electricity we use is being supplied to the grid by solar energy. We care deeply about our children's and our grandchildren's future. We are proud to be a small part of the program that has installed the great majority of PV installed in our state and that serves as a beacon to other states. I strongly support the bill's extension of the community solar program to all public utilities and its elimination of the contiguous county provision that's now in effect. I have a number of friends across the state who have wanted to become community solar subscribers but who have been unable to do so, either because they are outside of Xcel's territory or because they are in Xcel's territory, but no subscriptions were available due to a lack of new interconnection availability in a county contiguous to the one that they lived in. These are all people who also want the option of ensuring that their electricity usage is covered by solar energy and who care deeply about the future of our planet. I strongly support the bill's provision to allow community solar installations to be up to 5 megawatts. One of the objections to community solar is that its cost of installation is slightly higher than that of utility scale solar. The current 1 megawatt limitation artificially limits economy of scale and ensures that the cost cannot come down. Finally, I strongly support the community access provision in the bill because it allows people who have been redlined out of the community solar program due to their income level or credit scores, but who also care deeply about their children's and their grandchildren's futures to participate. I thank you for the chance to speak here today.
Thank you. Next, we have Timothy Denherter-Thomas, and he'll be followed by Kevin Cray. Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Kraft and representatives. My name is Timothy Denherter-Thomas. I'm General Manager of Cooperative Energy Futures. We are a member-owned clean energy co-op with about 1,000 member owners across Minnesota. You heard from Natividad, one of our members, earlier in a hearing. We're really focused on community solar that is serving residents and serving low-income families. We have members who are part of manufactured housing parks, residents of affordable housing, individuals who are renters who wouldn't be able to access solar on their own, really a broad diversity of impacted communities who wouldn't have other opportunities to participate in solar. And we've been recognized as a leader in this industry from an equity perspective by the U.S. Department of Energy as a grand prize winner in the Sunny Awards for Equitable Community Solar. Minnesota's community solar program is really a key pillar of our success in bringing equity to the solar industry. It's a pathway for people to reduce their bills and build wealth in the community. There are many flavors of community solar, and while we think it's really important that there is a broad diversity of subscribers in the program, we do think it's important to increase and support the level of residential and low-income participation and access to the program, which is part of why we support House File 2432 for really doubling down on that equitable focus and that access to community solar. We think it's really important that as we think about our energy future, we're giving all Minnesotans the opportunity to lead, to participate, and to benefit. And we think this is a really important step in that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Kevin Cray, and Kevin will be followed by Reed Richardson.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2432 today. My name is Kevin Cray, and I'm a Senior Regional Director for the Coalition for Community Solar Access, or CCSA. CCSA is the national trade organization solely focused on the community solar industry. We're active across virtually all community solar markets in the country, as well as at the federal level. Our mission is to expand customer choice and access to benefits to all Americans, regardless of their ability to host solar at their home or business. I'd like to talk today about a couple of the common sense provisions that this bill looks to modernize the community solar program in Minnesota in alignment with best practices across the country. Number one, to the best of my knowledge, Minnesota is the sole remaining state that has a regressive subscriber restriction policy that does not allow broad participation in the program and equal access for all communities. Further, by removing the contiguous county restriction, we've seen reduced interconnection congestion in other markets and a much swifter and more efficient market overall. Second, the increase in project size will reduce additional barriers to entry. It will allow for common sense abilities for projects to focus on efficiencies and bringing down costs to the program. If you think about it from an interconnection perspective, by allowing for 2, 3, 4, 5 megawatts, we're simply cutting down on the number of interconnection requests and applications that the utilities need to process, and this will increase efficiency and allow them to bring on more solar arrays across the state. Lastly, there is a whole suite of newly approved federal incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. Accessing these new federal incentives does require that the state positions itself for success. Whether you like or hate the new provisions of these federal taxes, Minnesotans are going to be paying into these tax coffers one way or the other. And so it's up to this legislature to make sure that the state is well positioned to recoup as many of those incentives as possible. In particular, there's an additional $7 billion of grant funding that was equitably spread across all the states. Each state would get about $140 million. I don't know that all states are well positioned to get that. Without taking these proactive steps to position Minnesota for success, you'll likely see those federal incentives go to states like Illinois, New York, and California that have proactively set themselves up for success in gaining access to those and bringing those benefits to their constituents. I urge your support on House File 2432. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, we have Reed Richardson, and Reed will be followed by Logan O'Grady. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reed Richardson, and I'm the president of U.S. Solar, a Minnesota-based developer active in Xcel Energy's community solar program since our founding in 2014. We are a full-scale turnkey developer and owner of community solar projects, starting from the initial discussions with our farmer landowner partners through permitting, subscription, construction, retaining ownership into the ongoing operations of the gardens once they go online. Here in Minnesota, we currently serve over 2,650 residential subscribers, both homeowners and renters, with a substantial portion of our capacity subscribed by public benefit institutions such as school districts, local governments, higher education, and county and state agencies. We also serve low-income subscribers and have to date committed to delivering over $130 million in electric bill savings to low to moderate income folks across the state, the various state markets in which we are active. By delivering these bill savings to these customers, we help them reduce costs and improve services. Also in Minnesota, the Community Solar Garden Program has contracted to provide over $300 million in rent payments for farmer landowners throughout Minnesota, providing them a valuable income stream to supplement volatile traditional farming and ranching. While doing this, U.S. Solar has been a leader in solar land use best practices, with each of our projects featuring native, deep-rooted, pollinator-friendly habitat, along with select sites having commercial honey production, sheep grazing, and starting in 2023, a pilot project with farmers growing food crops between and amongst these solar panels. Government programs exist, like USDA's Conservation Reserve Program, to pay farmers to leave land idle with the goal to improve soil and water quality, reduce erosion, and provide habitat for wildlife and pollinators. Every site we construct is essentially solar-funded CRP, reducing government expenses and actually giving more economic benefit to the rural communities. Unfortunately, due to the contiguous county restriction, we're extremely limited on the amount of residential and low-income subscribers that can participate in savings from our projects. There's also tremendous demand from Minnesotans for this program. So on one hand, we have ratepayers who want to opt in and subscribe. On the other hand, we have farmer landowners that want to host community solar on a portion of their property. However, the arbitrary county restriction imposes a substantial barrier, and neither party wins. So they both want to participate in the same program, but can't. In previous years, we've heard arguments for sunsetting the CSG program, supposedly due to high ratepayer costs. We feel there's an important distinction to be made between the older legacy gardens of the Phase 1 program versus any new gardens that come online today. CSG applications from the launch of the program up until 2016 provided subscribers bill credits at the applicable retail rate, ARR, which fluctuates up or down with XL retail rates. In 2014, ARR was 12.5 cents a kilowatt hour, and now it's 16.5, and it keeps rising as prevailing retail rates do. The current Phase 2 of the CSG program uses the value of solar pricing structure, or VOS. VOS is a science-derived fair market rate based on the value of the solar generation, including avoided fuel, generation, transmission, distribution, environmental costs. Here is the problem. ARR rates are about 50% higher than VOS, according to Excel filings, approximately 80% of the installed CSG capacity is from the legacy Phase 1 ARR program. So the costs routinely referenced are from legacy CSGs, which sunsetted new applications back in 2016. Conversely, since the program moved to Phase 2, value of solar, CSG bill credits are paid, the bill credits are paid by the utility to the subscribers at the exact same cost as the value generated. That's cost neutrality, ratepayer indifference. That was the intention of value of solar in the first place when the legislature and commerce developed it. I think that's mission accomplished. So U.S. Solar, our farmer landowner partners and their communities, hundreds of job seekers and thousands of hopeful subscribers encourage passage of House File 2432 to energize what once was and could be again the nation's most successful community solar program. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Logan O'Grady, and Logan will be followed by Rick Evans. Welcome back. Please state your name again and testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Logan O'Grady, Executive Director of MNCEA. I think what you're hearing here is the Community Solar Garden program that was established in 2013 has been hugely successful. We were the number one program in the country until last year. That is something that Minnesota should be proud of. And I think that over the last, you know, many committee meetings that I've sat in, this program has been undermined and attacked for being so successful. Of Minnesota's 1,763 megawatts of solar, 860 megawatts comes from the CSG program. This program was intended to serve both residential and commercial subscribers. We know this because in statute, it requires a minimum of 5 subscribers to one garden. And one subscriber may take up 40% of the garden's capacity. So the legislative intent of this program was to serve both residential and commercial subscribers. It's an opt-in program that allows Minnesotans choice in the options to directly participate in Minnesota's transition to a clean energy future. The program has over 28,000 subscribers. 24,861 of those are residential. That's 86% of the subscribers in the program are residential. Despite this success, our utility partner has been trying to eliminate this program for years, and the reason is because they don't own it and they can't make money off of it. They use this ownership issue as a cost concern, and Excel uses a guise of ratepayer concern to fight against the CSG program. So I just encourage committee members, as you likely will hear about cost issues in the program, costs given to you by utilities for utility scale solar projects often leave out important costs, including the cost of transmission, which one study shows is 8.8 cents. So the 3 cents that you're being told a utility-scale solar project can be built does not include 8 cents for transmission. Additionally, it doesn't include the 10% authorized rate of return that utilities are given. So I can stick around for questions. I think that this is a win-win-win program, as has been proven over the 10 years of the existence of this program, and I encourage you to support expanding it.
Thank you. And finally, we have Rick Evans. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Either there's another side to the story or I'm the dumbest guy in the room. I guess you'll all decide by the time we're done here. First of all, I do want to say that Xcel Energy has never sponsored or asked anyone to sponsor a bill that would eliminate the community solar garden program. We have spent the last, I personally have spent the last 3 to 5 years working on reforms to this program. We think there's a place for distributed generation, small distributed generation on our system. We would like to see it happen. We would like to see Mr. O'Grady's members have thriving businesses going forward doing small distribution connected solar. So I'll disagree with my friend Logan. We have not tried to eliminate this program. We've tried to improve the program, and that's what I'd like to address just briefly in the time I have here. The program was created in 2013 in legislation. Its intent was to be a modest program that would provide an opportunity to participate in solar with people who didn't own roofs or people that had roofs that were in poor condition. What's developed over the last 10 years was not what was intended when we started, and it shows a serious need for reform of the program, not elimination, but reform of the program. And we do appreciate Chair Akam for bringing a bill to start this conversation. It absolutely has to take place. We're not a supporter of everything in her bill. We think there are some other things that need to be added, and I'd be happy to talk about those at some point when we have more time. There are three concerns with the Community Solar Garden Program that we have at Xcel Energy, and one of them is not that we don't own it. We buy lots of energy from people, from wind farms, from solar farms, from hydro, that we don't own the generation. That's part of our business model. So the problem with community solar gardens is not that we don't own it. The problem with solar gardens is, first of all, it's very expensive. Even at the value of solar rate, it is something like double the cost of other solar that we could procure on the market. It's 13 point, this year, the value of solar, I think, is going to be about 13.3 cents per kilowatt hour. We can buy solar. We bought solar as low as 4 cents a kilowatt hour. It's getting a little more expensive now because, I think, of supply chain problems. But now it's about 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour, but still significantly lower than the value of solar. Those costs are passed through directly to our customers. We don't keep any of that money. We don't mark it up. It really passes right through, just like every other energy contract that we have with a wind developer, a solar developer, or a hydro plant. We pass that directly through to our customers. So it is paid by our millions of customers who purchase energy from us. And these are 20-year contracts. So that price of energy is once we've signed the contract and the garden is built, that price does not come down for that energy. Furthermore, and this is really key to one of the reforms we need to look at, is that if there are savings through economies of scale, or if there's federal money available to buy down the cost of building a solar garden, because of the structure of the value of solar, our customers will see zero of that savings. That money will all go into the pockets of the developers under the current structure, and that's a reform that needs to be addressed. As we think particularly about whether we're going to see economies of scale or we're going to see other money coming into the program. The second problem that we have with the program is that the benefits are extremely inequitable. First of all, you need to understand that as we pay that 13.3 cents per kilowatt hour, 90% of that, or roughly 90%, goes to the developer or the owner of the garden. I'm not sure if it's true today, but a couple of years ago, the biggest owner of solar gardens in Minnesota was Warren Buffett. The second biggest owner was NextEra, the large energy conglomerate based in Florida. So 90% of the price that we pay, that our customers pay for this energy, goes to large national corporations that own the solar gardens. Of the 10% that's left, 80% of that goes to corporate customers or to the large institutional customers like schools and governments. And so the fraction of the money that ends up going to our residential customers is a very small part of the money that is generated by the community solar gardens. That creates an inequity. And while we appreciate the work of Mr. Denherter Thomas to try to direct that towards low-income customers, The fact is, as one of the witnesses testified, the rest of the solar garden companies could continue to do what he called redlining and essentially not share the benefits. So while I applaud Mr. Denherter Thomas's intention to direct this towards low-income customers, the fact is that the bulk of the solar gardens do not. In fact, some of the solar gardens actually will put a credit test, and you can't be a subscriber to their solar garden if you don't meet their credit rating. So low-income customers are excluded. Not only not invited, but they're excluded from those programs. And the third thing that is causing a problem for the company, a problem for this program, is that our distribution grid was not built to take this enormous amount of energy, which is connected at the distribution level. And we have places, and increasingly growing places in Minnesota, where you can't even put a rooftop system on your home because the line of community solar garden programs waiting in line to interconnect with our system are ahead of you in line. And so I hear, you know, from local legislators, I have a constituent who would like to put solar on their rooftop, and they're being told they can't. And the reason they're being told that is because the community solar gardens have taken up all of the space on the grid, and they continue to form a line to get on the grid. And if you happen to be behind them with your rooftop system, you're stuck until we deal with those. And developing the distribution grid to deal with those problems is an enormously complicated and expensive proposition. Now, it is true that if we remove the contiguous county requirement, which could be part of a good reform going forward, that if we do nothing else, that will free up some space for a while. But there's nothing that's in this bill, nothing being proposed that we would like to talk about, which would prevent it from, we'll be back here in 2 years and we'll have all of those feeders jammed full of projects waiting to get online, and we won't have accomplished anything. So a reform not only needs to deal with opening up more areas on the grid, but it needs to make sure that we don't end up a couple of years down the road in this very same situation. So in short, House File 2432 really does not address all of the problems that this program has. It addresses some of them. We've talked about this with Chair Akam, and she has been very gracious in her time and also indicating that she wants to continue to work on the reform to make sure that some of these concerns that we've raised are addressed, and we really, really thank you for that and look forward to those conversations. The last thing I will say to the members is this program is extremely complicated. The way the money flows, the way the energy flows, the way this works is very complicated. I could take way more time than you're going to spend with me today explaining that. I would be happy to meet with any of you individually or in a group and talk about this so that you understand, as we build this reform, you understand how the program is actually working and what needs to be done to make sure that it has a future. With that, I'll end, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We had a lot of testifiers. Before I move to questions, I want to offer the chair if you'd like to make any comments.
No, I think it was really just great to hear from a wide variety of people and different perspectives, and so I am grateful to all of them for taking the time and grateful to Mr. Evans as well, and so happy to turn to member questions. Okay.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just really quick, Mr. Eloff, we have heard about the people outside, more people want access to this community solar program. I was not aware that there was a prohibition in law prohibiting other cooperative service utilities or other investor-owned utilities from being able to offer community solar. Is there currently a prohibition on community solar being offered to ratepayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the current statute governing community solar gardens required Xcel to have such a program, but it does not prohibit any other utility from doing so, although they would have to have that program approved by the commission.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, first of all, I want to thank the chair of the committee for having a hearing on community solar. As Mr. Evans said, and I would hope members of the committee realize, this is a 10-year program that is extraordinarily complex. And I think all of us, regardless of our opinions, have a responsibility to understand how this program was created and how it's evolved and worked. And so I think by bringing this bill forward, the chair is wisely focusing on the fact that there are changes that are needed to the program. And I want to thank you for doing that. Whenever you touch an existing program that people are making a lot of money off of, you're no pun intended, you're grabbing onto an electric wire, you're grabbing onto a live wire. And so I want to just thank you for bringing that forward. I just want to highlight a couple of things for members of the committee to understand. First of all, if you heard customers of Community Solar come up and talk about how their electric rates are lower, right, that they're paying less than electricity, but you also know that those who are producing this energy are getting reimbursed at a higher rate than the other forms of energy. Okay, just think about that. The customers who are signed up are paying less, and the people who are producing the energy are making more. How does that work? Well, I'll tell you how it works. It's the screw your neighbor policy. That's how it's happening. This is cost shifting. Okay, so the energy that's being produced does not have a more environmentally responsible footprint than other forms of solar or wind. Okay? The energy that's being created, there's nothing inherently better about it. It's just more expensive. And the way it's being paid, Mr. Evans, what is the community solar, what's the latest number on what that is in the fuel and tax clause right now annually?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, so currently the fuel clause, I should say for the year 2022 is what I looked up, and that was about $950 million flows through the fuel clause to our customers. Of that, almost 17% or $160 million is community solar garden expenses.
Representative Russell,
thank you. So $160 million?
Yes.
Okay, so $160 million, that's what's being put on the customers' bills and is being shifted across the rate base to everyone. Now, we have been told in this, and I have to tell you, there's a level of disconnect here when people talk about the stunning success of this community solar program. Yeah, if it's so stunningly successful, why hasn't no one else on the planet copied that? Okay, it's been a disaster. Those of us who have attended energy conferences know that community solar projects that are developed in laws in other states, the running joke was, whatever you do, don't design your program like Minnesota. Okay? It's a great program for the people who are making money off it. And for the commercial users who are using this, the Targets, the Ecolabs, the Fortune 500 companies that are getting reductions in their bill, fabulous program for you, for them, right? But for everybody else, all we are doing is paying more money for energy. It's no more cleaner than other carbon-free sources, okay? It's no more reliable than other sources. All we're doing is wasting money. So I think the chair is wise to bring this bill forward. There are ways to get rid of the subsidies and the mandates. There are ways to do RFPs to change this process. But members of the committee, please, please do not walk out of this committee today with this misunderstanding that somehow the community solar program that we're working under right now is a good idea and that it's been working well for Minnesota. It hasn't, it won't, and by any objective measurement of cost, performance, environmental standards, it is something that should not be mitigated or should not be replicated. Okay? So again, I want to thank the chair of the committee for having this hearing on this bill. Thank you for raising awareness of this. This is something that needs to change. We are unnecessarily wasting money right now. It goes beyond clean energy versus dirty energy, tomorrow versus yesterday. It goes beyond that. But members, please study the community solar program to understand who the small sliver of beneficiaries are that are making money off this, off of the costs and burden for every one of the people who live in the Xcel Energy Service Territory. Thank you.
Not hearing a question, I'll go to Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. So we heard earlier, so it's $160 million is the approximate fuel cost for community solar, which would be about 17% of the fuel cost. What percentage of the actual energy of that portfolio is it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, for 2022, it was, I believe, 3.3% of the energy came from solar gardens.
All right. So, Thank you. So what that means, folks, is that 17% of the cost produces 3.3% of the energy. So if you're using 100 watts, 3.3 of those watts come from community solar, but cost you 17% of the total cost. That's not success, folks. That's failing ratepayers in Xcel Energy country. And this is a very complicated issue, but Madam Chair, just looking at it, I don't think this reforms it in a way that we're going to use less of it. You know, we already have, I believe, 860 megawatts of this energy in the pipeline. We're to the point, if we just do simple things here that may be innocent, like Representative Holland's bill to require that any industrial solar also has a corresponding battery associated with cost, you're going to not only disincentivize the amount of industrial affordable solar, but on the industrial scale, but you're going to force even more of this. And if it's going to expand, I would recommend that you would have a hard cap to say that at no point can the projects can't like get industrial solar or rate solar off the market. It can't squeeze it out. So it needs to fill in the cracks at least, so that, you know, we can at least do what's best for ratepayers. But, you know, my guess is that you would see if you're going to, you know, move it from a single megawatt, which is about 7 acres. Now, if you move it to 5, it's going to be on average, each site's going to be 35 acres. So there's going to be cost savings to the development of, I'm not sure how much that would save as far as the development, but ratepayers should be able to enjoy that savings, not the developers. And then on top of that, if you wanted to improve the program, you should, any grants that are coming from the federal government, we just heard from, I believe it was Kevin Cray, that over $150 million potentially will come to the state of Minnesota in grants. Do the ratepayers get to enjoy that in community solar, or are the beneficiaries of the developers going to be able to pocket that, whether they keep it in Minnesota or they keep it elsewhere? You know, those are dollars that essentially could go to either ratepayers, an Xcel Center. You know, those are ways that you could potentially improve it so that we capture those federal dollars that were printed out of nothing, and at least it could buy down the potential. And then look at how it's going to affect other programs within the system. I called out Representative Holland's bill. I apologize to do that. But that would really put a disadvantage to building, you know, industrial-level solar. And, you know, what is the goal? Like, this bill expands the program. Under current rules, we already have over 860 megawatts of community solar garden. Does the author of the bill have any idea what more development would happen under community solar if this bill was to pass into law and be executed over the next 10 years? What is the goal? Like, is there any caps to limit it? Is there, what do you think is going to happen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the comments, Representative Swedzinski. What I will say about community solar gardens is that along with other types of solar, they fit a need. And so you can say it is better to have only utility scale solar, and unfortunately transmission becomes a huge cost driver for that. And so the flexibility of smaller projects that can be placed in places where we have capacity on the grid make it a very good solution. And so I appreciate that we can cherry pick statistics and data to try and skew a vision. But I think there are there is a much needed place within our state and our energy mix for rooftop, for community scale solar, as well as utility. And they all fit different needs. And so when I think about this program and expanding this program, the goal is to, one, help fulfill our 100% clean energy goals. And we have utilities all across the state that are going to need to be putting more focus on that. So this will help with that and the renewable energy credits that will be needed. It will fill a need to address reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So I think that any renewable energy, solar included,
are a direction that we need to be doing more of in order to reach our goals and to protect the state and our country for the future, as one of our testifiers was referring to, leaving a place for our grandchildren. And so the goals are many.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair and Representative Akam. Is there, we had about five or six developers here. Is there an estimate within your business models on what percentage? So if you've already, if your production is 3.3% at 860 megawatts by the expansion of this bill, what is your estimates and your increase in outlays is how much more production that you'll be able to put on the ground if this bill passes? Is it a tripling of this? Is it a quadrupling of this? This number of this 860 megawatts that represents 3.3% of production in Xcel territory. What would be your, I mean, you guys are here for a reason. You're advocating for this bill. I'd like one of you to just explain how much more you think you'll be able to sell in the next 10 years if this bill passes.
Mr. Chair, while somebody's thinking about that,
please,
may I?
Madam Chair.
So I have a graph here, and I apologize I didn't have it for members' packets, but it looks at utilities and the needed resources and expected resources across 104 utilities across the country. And I can pass it around for you to look at, but it shows us here today, and here's 2034. And what we'll need, the yellow you can see pretty brightly across the room, is the expansion of solar. And so I think that there is a certainly a demonstrated need, and that's what this program is intended to fill.
Is there anyone that wants to? I'll also mention it's coming down. So just we went past 4:30, but we have the ability to go until 5:30 tonight in this committee. Please reintroduce yourself.
Yes, Reed Richardson, U.S. Solar. Thank you for the question. I mean, it's a complicated question because it relies on a lot of factors. You know, and as a developer of these projects, we're never guaranteed success just because there's a program that allows it. We still have to choose the right locations. People still want to have to participate. We still have to ensure safe, reliable, you know, access to interconnect to the grid. What I can say is that when you look at what other states are doing, New York has a roadmap to 10 gigawatts of distributed generation. I don't anticipate that Minnesota will get close to that. And I would say that by our calculation, I think community solar is serving closer to 5% of the retail load here. So I do think that the reforms proposed in this bill would allow for additional development. I think the key thing is that it would allow for additional subscribers to benefit and to opt in. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you. Appreciate that your testimony on that. So, I mean, just from an average, my guess is that, I mean, if we're just doing back-of-the-napkin stuff, this bill, by, you know, quadrupling the size and then opening the scope, you know, we're told that the biggest limitation of this has been the contiguous counties, which I have an amendment to potentially keep. I don't know if the committee would potentially think about accepting it as a friendly, but my guess is you'd at least see a tripling of your market share. And if that were to happen, you would move your 160 to 460 to $450 million just as a percentage. So that gets you close to 10% of total consumption. So you'd probably see, you know, a 10% of production through the community solar program after the next 10 years at a total cost, which would be almost half of the load of cost for a fuel rate charge that only produces 10%. I mean, do you feel that there's a point where there might just be too much good when it comes to rates and ratepayers and the cost that's passed on to them as business owners that are trying to develop businesses and families trying to, you know, do it? Like, do you think we could, I mean, feasibly just say, hey, let's just, at some point, what is success? Is it 10% of, you know, the fuel load? Is it 20%? I mean, could we put a number on it as far as like, hey, we're going to expand the program so whoever wants to get in it can get it up to X amount of production? I mean, do you think that's a reasonable request?
Mr. Richardson, and then I'm going to also ask Mr. Denherter Thomas to make a comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. A few points. Number one, I think your estimates sound pretty confident and they exceed ours, so I'd love to speak with you about where we should go develop all those projects. I hope that is the case. I think that's probably not so dramatic. The other thing I would say is that because we aren't guaranteed success in this program, there still has to be a demand. There has to be competition. We aren't a monopoly. We don't get a guaranteed rate of return, so we have to compete against retail rates. We have to compete against other programs. We have to compete against other developers and other competing interests. So I would say that as long as there is a location that can host community solar, and as long as there is interconnect capacity, and as long as there is demand, that is a triple win in my book, and I hope that we can continue to do that.
I think Mr. Denherter Thomas wants to make a comment since you asked for developers.
Thanks, Reid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swidzinski. I wanted to pull out a couple of details just about the kind of apples to oranges conversation that we're having. In a community solar garden, 100% of the cost is passed through to the fuel clause. This is the cost of building the infrastructure, the cost of Xcel's expenses to connect to the grid, the cost of delivering the infrastructure, all of that lands in the fuel clause. For a utility scale project, the cost of delivering that energy to that point on the grid is passed through to the fuel clause if it's not a utility-owned project. But the cost of building transmission or backup power to supply that system or other costs involved in delivering that energy are paid by utility ratepayers through Xcel's other charges, not on the fuel clause. There's a lot of different factors in terms of how cost is caused here. It's the cost of fuel, it's the cost of infrastructure, it's the cost of transmission, distribution, et cetera, all of that. It's a really complex calculation. Minnesota went through the process almost 10 years ago to define a methodology for how we calculate those costs and how we ensure that ratepayers are being held harmless. That's the definition of the value of solar. The Department of Commerce at the time made a very clear statement: this is not a cost shift. We are calculating all of the ways that ratepayers are saving money up and down the value chain of energy, and that's what we're going to compensate the community solar. Xcel Energy at the time also had an executive who said, this is the right way to do solar. This is a fair way of compensating for energy. I think that distinction is really important to pull apart, because when you say it's 17% of the fuel clause is only 25-30% of our total utility bill. All of the rest of it is stuff that we pay for infrastructure that we allow the utility to finance and that we all pay for. We need to make sure we're comparing these things really apples to apples.
Representative Swidzinski, before I go to the next, would you like to offer your amendment?
Yeah, we could probably do that, if that's what you prefer. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Swidzinski moves the A1 amendment, so tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment is pretty straightforward. We hear about, this the committee's had this bill in front of us for, many different years, trying to change or reform the community solar. And one of the things we've heard primarily from a majority of the testifiers was that enjoyment of community and keeping it close so that they may not be able to have it on their roof, but they could see it potentially up the street. And the idea that we would move that beyond contiguous county is really, I think, an unfortunate, because I think that's really one of the true values of the current bill, is that we make sure that the community is in the program, where it's at least, if it's not in the county that you're in, that it would be at least within a touching county. And I think that's important when you talk about the testifier that just spoke, talked a lot about that, the cost of distribution. How on the fuel charge, a vast majority of ratepayers have to pay those costs. And the further away that you build these projects from the consumer, which would be the prescriber, technically, whether it be Warren Buffett or the Nexa Energy or the folks that live in Minneapolis, the closer that is, the less transmission costs there are. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And so my amendment strikes the contiguous county and just allows it to be within the county, so that the folks that truly want to have it can see it and enjoy it and protect it as something that's their own, not something that's a large corporate development far away that they'll never see or be able to enjoy. out in the countryside, but it keeps it close so that we really can keep the community in, keep the community solar program in the community that it's derived from. And I'd ask for your support.
Chair Akram.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski. And I would respectfully ask for a no vote on the amendment. The intention of this bill and of expanding the community solar program is to provide more opportunities and places for it to be. Right now we're seeing challenges with interconnection, and as we heard in from several of our testifiers, long waits in order to be able to get projects on the grid. And so I think that by limiting it even further will only make that a bigger problem. And frankly, there are places in rural Minnesota where for the contiguous counties piece, if we removed that, and the touching county wouldn't necessarily be within the same utility. And so there can be problems about being able to implement projects.
Any further discussion? Oh, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Swazinski, thank you for bringing this amendment forward. I do think it's important to recognize that the committee right now is debating two different things using the same words, and that is we are debating cost versus price. Cost versus price. We have heard from testifiers coming forward that the price they are paying for their energy is less. $25 was said by one testifier, and that is true, that this program is resulting in a lower price for some payers, but the cost is higher. The cost is being shifted among all ratepayers. So what Representative Swazinski is doing here is zeroing in on the issue of the contiguous counties, is what is the impact on cost? Not on price, on cost. So by having these farms located farther away from the people they're serving, doesn't that increase the cost? Didn't we just hear from people that the benefit to community solar is that it needs to be on the other side of the distribution grid? And then by moving this out farther away, we're now increasing the cost by allowing it to extend it into counties. Cost versus price. The second side of this is, how do I articulate this in a better way than I have been to convince my colleagues? This program, the community solar program, there is nothing, this right now just limits Xcel. If other investor-owned utilities customers want this, if cooperatives utilities customers want this, these programs can be set up. In fact, I believe Steel Waseca, they had a community solar program set up a couple years ago, and there was no cost shifting in it. They did come up with a way where people, in exchange for signing up for community solar and then using electric water heaters for demand response, I'm pretty sure about that they were able to do that. So there are community solar programs that do exist. It's just not mandatory. It's not required. And we don't allow the Public Utilities Commission to set rates, particularly for cooperative service utilities, on what they have to buy their energy for. So Representative Swazinski, thank you for bringing your amendment forward. I'm going to vote for it, and I would hope other people do, too. Thank you.
Any comments? Representative comments? Okay. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Nay. With that, the motion
I said the wrong
fail.
Word. I voted against.
The amendment is not adopted. Okay. We have some more questions.
Right. No, honey, I don't think so.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. And I guess I want to talk a little bit again, this eliminating the contiguous county requirement, and a little bit talking about just from the perspective of greater Minnesota, what that means to agricultural land. And I'm not sure we're putting enough weight on this. So when we're looking at the urban area, instead of eliminating this, which then is pushing gardens out, and I think one of the testifiers said, then she would not have to have it on her building. Every time that happens, it's going out potentially to good agricultural land. So I would just first like to ask you, is there a consideration to get more creative of where these solar gardens can be placed in the metro area, like, you know, I've seen in Red Wing where it's gone over a parking lot. Can we get more creative so we're not pushing this out and taking agricultural land for this?
Jerry.
Thank you for the question. Actually, that's a really good question. And there was a community solar garden built on North High in Minneapolis, and unfortunately, it's still waiting to be interconnected. And so there are attempts to be creative and use rooftops within communities for that. And as far as using farmland, I will say none of this is forced on a farmer. There's no eminent domain. This is a product that's being marketed, and farmers frankly prefer having a diversity of income opportunities and welcome the chance to do this. And frankly, I will also just point out the combination that's going on between community solar gardens and other uses of land, whether it be grazing animals, raising vegetables, having pollinators and raising honey or making honey. I think that these can be mutually beneficial projects within communities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. So I am aware that on farmland, solar companies are paying approximately $1,000 to $1,500 per acre to rent that land. First of all, does that sound correct to you? And then second of all, do you know what a farmer is renting to another farmer that same land?
Madam Chair?
No, I don't have those. Not being a solar developer, I don't have that those numbers, but I know what they're getting is a market value that a farmer is taking willingly. And so it is not being forced on them. They aren't being given below market rates for their land and for the use of their land. They're being – I can finish. Yes.
Oh, no, I wasn't saying – that wasn't my point. I didn't mean, no, you can't finish it.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to. My point wasn't that the farmer is not being paid. The farmer is being paid way above what they are if they're renting that as agricultural land.
Madam Chair.
And so I guess, do you not want farmers to have opportunities to make income on their land?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this up. So this is my point exactly. As we are subsidizing solar companies to go and to produce these solar gardens, what's happening in the agricultural world is that solar companies are paying farmers $1,000 to $1,500 per acre. Now, if a farmer is to rent that to another farmer, they are getting approximately $200 to $300 per acre. So I am not saying that I don't want a farmer to make money. That is absolutely not what I'm saying, Madam Chair. What I'm saying is solar companies are hugely subsidized. They are turning this huge profit, and so they're able to then pay rent for that farmland to the farmer at, you know, 5 to 6 times the rate that they are getting renting that land to agriculture. So it's a business, correct? The government is weighing heavily subsidizing solar companies, which is able to do this. Now what's that happening to farmland? Well, we are in rural Minnesota, we are now competing against these corporations to keep our farmland. So if you're a farmer, and it's not that I don't want a farmer to have profit, absolutely not, but what are you going to do if you're a farmer and you have all this acreage of land? Are you going to rent it to a solar company and get $1,000 to $1,500 per acre, or are you going to rent it to another farmer and get $200 to $300 per acre? So I think that's pretty common sense what's going to happen. But what I want to teach the committee, so please stay with me here, is we have to look at facts and numbers. Please work with me. Okay, take some notes, and I'm going to use this as an example because anyone can Google this. This is abundantly available information. Please Google, the largest solar farm is about to be built in Indiana, and it's 13,000 acres. Okay? So you can Google this, and then you can find out how many households will a 13,000-acre solar farm power. And the answer to that is 200,000 homes. Okay? Now, if it's so, if a 13,000-acre solar farm is powering 200,000 homes, and you take the population of Indiana, that solar is only going to be powering, I believe it's like 3% of the because there's four people per home, so it'd be like 12% of the population. Now, every time we are taking productive land out of agriculture, okay, so again, please just stick with me because this actually is very important. When we are taking land out of production, 1 acre of productive land is producing 180 bushels of corn. Again, easily searchable. You can check my numbers. One bushel of corn produces 6 pounds of beef. So every time we are taking an acre of land out of production, we are potentially taking thousands and millions of dollars of corn and beef out of production. This is true. So as we reduce our agriculture production, we are going to drive up food costs. And so this has to be considered when we're putting these limits. I understand that you have a 2040 goal. I understand that we're working backwards now to reach the 2040 goal. But this does have unintended consequences as we continue to chop away and to continue to take this ag land out of production. So please, there's other solutions here. There really is other solutions. You can do this and you can wait and be patient and build the infrastructure and move to doing the rooftop solar or doing the canopy solar over parking lots. But I would really caution the committee to understand the impact, the long-term impact this is going to have on agriculture, which then will drive up your food prices, which does affect every person in Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, other chair. Confusing. So I am asking from a genuine place of curiosity, and I don't think I'm asking you as the bill author, but I've heard a lot of comments about how our community solar program is not one to be replicated across the country. And I'm interested, I think it was Mr. Cray who testified, who said he had worked with other states in this. And I was just wondering if he would be able to come forward and talk about his experience working with other states and where our community solar program kind of lands in that space.
You'd restate your name and answer the question, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Kevin Cray with CCSA. Mr. Chair, Representative. I work actively in about six states leading CCSA's efforts, and I touch about another half dozen as well. I would say Minnesota is brought up consistently as a model in every state that I work in. Most recently, Arizona passed their energy landscape is a little different in that the legislature doesn't actually have authority over energy policy, but it falls with their commission, which is the ACC. The ACC specifically asked their staff to model Minnesota's program when coming back with policy recommendations. We've seen legislation introduced in Montana that largely mirrored Minnesota's legislation. We've seen legislation that's yet to be introduced in Alaska, largely mirroring Minnesota's legislation. I would say the top three states that I get asked about in my region are Minnesota, Colorado, because it was the first state with community solar, Minnesota, because it was the first state that really scaled community solar, and then New York, because that's now the current leader in the community solar space. So I guess I would not agree with Representative Galofalo's, framing that Minnesota is not a model. I think it has been a very successful program. I think it's something that states across the country look to as a model to both pace their program after and to learn from. I'm not here to say that there aren't some fundamental changes that are needed to the program, but to say that it's not been wildly successful and a model that other states have pursued to be similar to would be just incorrect from my perspective.
Okay. Representative Zinsky.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, from a, you know, would the author of the bill consider any sort of a limitation on the capping this as how large it could be?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Susinski, I am open to working with all the stakeholders to come up with a program that is sustainable, economically sound, and equitable. And so, yes, I'm, as I have said to the utilities in the room, as I have said to community organizations and the developers, I am open to conversations to talk about ways that we can make this program more sustainable and economically sound. So yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we've talked about some numbers. I mean, would you, you know, entertain some numbers? Have you talked about specific numbers? Like, if you're open to the idea, like, what would you be open to as far as, you know, just kind of setting a cap as far as how much development there would be?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not going to put a number on that yet. I really I want to work in this process with the people who are involved in it. And instead of trying to come up with those numbers around a table of legislators, I want to instead work with the people who work in this every day, the experts who are part of this program.
Mr. Cray, you seem to work in a lot of different states. Do other states have any sort of a limitation on size when it comes to community solar as far as what percentage of their portfolio they would potentially implement?
Mr. Cray?
Mr. Chair, Representative, caps can be common across other states. I think, you know, each state has approached it in a little bit of a different fashion. I'm not aware of any hard-coded caps in a statute to say, like, they're going to be 1,552 megawatts of community solar and that's it. Per the chair's recommendation, a lot of times that'll fall back to the Public Utilities Commission to actually kind of work within what a cap may or may not want to look like, just because then you bring in experts and expert testimony into the fold.
Thank you. So you wouldn't see there's a specific number. What have you seen as far as, you know, kind of what the guidance of other PUCs have done across different states?
Mr. Cray?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we've seen a wide swath of different approaches. A lot of times it kind of depends on the will of the state to enable it where they're at in the life cycle of their renewable energy journey. If you look at states like California that are kind of very much ahead in the rooftop solar space, it's taken them a long time to get into the community solar aspect of things. Leading the nation today is really New York, in that they've established kind of a 10 gigawatt overall goal for DG, and community solar is a component of that. I do encourage people to think long term and create kind of a vision for these types of programs, that we have a North Star that everyone can work towards in collaboration.
Representative,
thank you. And then just to wrap up, you know, I think, you know, when you look at customers, you know, folks would probably, if they had to choose on their bill, hey, I want to have solar, I think those are already options. If you want to utilize solar through the Excel bill, you can kind of do a checkoff, I believe, or something like that exists. Would the author of the bill consider allowing customers to choose their solar? So essentially put on a Excel bill, hey, I want solar. Do you want, you know, 4 cent solar, or do you want, you know, 13.3 cent solar, and allow the customers to choose? No, because, I mean, if we're not going to set a number in this, you know, I think the general public, quite frankly, they may want solar, I don't know. But let them choose which one it is, and that might actually allow, so rather say, hey, people want solar, they want solar. Well, let them choose which one they want. Do you want, you know, Warren Buffett solar, or do you want, you know, ratepayer solar? And let them choose, and that would potentially either limit or expand it. And that way the market genuinely, because we hear a lot about from the testifiers how this is such a market-driven space, but that would truly let the market drive whether we feel we need to expand the amount of community solar or just allow solar to be built as the industry plans. Would you consider that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Swazinski, to your question, I had some conversations with Mr. Evans with Xcel Energy recently talking about utility scale solar, talking about community solar, and his question to me was, as a utility, they have an interest in having small projects throughout their resource capacity, because they can be flexible in where they're
position so they can fill in where there's capacity on the grid. And so I appreciate the, you know, cherry picking of 3 cents for utility scale that's not taking into account the transmission that needs to be built in order to accommodate that. And so when, you know, I don't think that's a fair analysis. And so I think that we need to consider that there is not a one-size-fits-all and that there are pros and cons to different types. And so recognizing that the utility sees that there are pros and cons to both utility as well as community solar, I think this is a beneficial program that people are interested in participating in and that we need to continue to provide.
Madam Chair, any final comments?
What I will just say is thanks for the discussion. This certainly, I would agree, is a complicated program. What I will say is I appreciate the point of prime farmland and corn production. And just to point out, if we're concerned about having solar on corn, on farmland that might be replacing corn, I think we should also be concerned about 40% of our corn crop in Minnesota goes to producing ethanol. So it's not going to make food, it's going to produce ethanol. And so as we consider the community solar program today, this is the start of a conversation in which I want all stakeholders to be participating in going forward. And as I said a moment ago, I want it to be a sustainable program, economically sound and equitable, and I will work in good faith to that on that path.
Okay, with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion, and we are adjourned.